Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the Christmas series of The Delicious Podcast with me, Julie Smith. And this week, Matt Tebbutt tells us about the festive feasts in his household. He was in town for the Saturday Kitchen Christmas party, but on the day that the news of the death of fellow TV chef Gary Rhodes was devastating the food industry, I started by asking about Gary's influence on him.
He was on TV at a time I was in university. And I was training, I was doing a geography degree and I was going into the Air Force, and I used to go flying with the Air Force on my days off and what have you. And I used to come back from an hour's flying exhausted, because it turns out it's quite taxing. And I used, the way I used to relax was to cook for my mates in the house. There were six of us, and I used to cook in the style of Gary Rhodes. And he had that very flamboyant way about him. So we used to mess around in the house, being all kind of flamboyant with our terrible student food. But I met him a couple of times since then, and he was such a lovely fella. And his impact on food and on TV, and he got the crossover. There's a lot of chefs that don't get the crossover between restaurants and how kind of formal they think they need to be, and getting the public on side. So he was absolutely brilliant at that. And also, his other big legacy was the fact that he took British food to a different level. I mean, it was at a time when everything was all about French food, but Gary came along and said, let's embrace oxtail, let's embrace faggots and liver and onions and all that great food. And he made that very, very sexy.
He was. I mean, that he was the original champion of local produce and roads around Britain in 1994. Yeah. It was the precursor to Two Fat Ladies. In fact, Pat Absolutely. Llewellyn, who produced Two Fat Ladies and found Jamie Oliver and put Gordon Ramsay on television, she actually said that she used to watch Gary Rhodes on Roads Around Britain and go, hang on a second, this guy's got something.
Is that right?
So actually, you could really make that path between Gary Rhodes, who, in the greater scheme, you know, was a chef, wasn't he?
He was a brilliant chef. I mean, he was. I first came across him at the Castle Hotel in Taunton. And he was a brilliant chef, you know, Michelin starred, very sort of high flying and very fine dining. And then he made that leap to TV and made all that kind of food kind of accessible and opened the public's eyes to it.
And of course, then did all that sort of Good Morning Television stuff and those sort of, you know, 5 minute things that, of course, you see on Phil Schofield and Holly Willoughby now. He was one of the very first people to do that. But actually, I think that, you know, and it's too early, I haven't read the obituaries today, and he died last night. Mm. But actually, I wonder if he will be seen as a chef's chef rather than a TV chef.
Well, I think it's a different thing, isn't it? I think to people, to the general public, he will be known as a TV chef. Within the chef world, he is absolutely a chef. I mean, the guy was brilliant at what he'd done. His restaurants were really, really good. He was a fantastic cook. So he has the benefit of both sides, I guess.
Yeah. Which leads me on to you, of course. So you were the man at the Fox Hunter in my hometown, virtually. I grew up in Abergavenny, and you were just around the corner in Nanterdery at the Fox Hunter, where you were a chef. Mm. And, you know, at a time when Abergavenny was just kind of coming to prominence. It was just after the Abergavenny Food Festival when you opened the Fox Hunter, wasn't it?
Probably about 15-something... No, it was more than that, about 18, 19 years ago, maybe.
Yeah. So it was around
something like that
time when really coming out of London.
Yeah, it was. It was because in that area there was the Walnut Tree, which has always been very famous. And that was kind of the linchpin, I suppose. And then the festival sprung up. And we were in London, and I used to work for various people in town, and I met my wife up here, and we've decided we want to move back. And it seemed like a good place. And we thought, well, if the walnut tree makes it and he's so busy all the time, even if we took a fraction of some of that trade, we'd do all right. And we did, and it worked, and it was a great place to have a restaurant. And at the time, we were doing the whole kind of seasonal, local, buying off the farms thing, which has become the norm. Yeah. But at the time, it was very unusual, you know.
It was unusual because, I mean, I grew up in Abergavenny, and the produce was always amazing. It wasn't called, you know, Abergavenny black beef. It was just called beef.
Yeah.
But it was amazing at that time. And there was a branding operation, wasn't there, about high welfare British meat and Welsh meat, which has proved to be a really important contributor to British cooking. Yeah. Was that a thing at the Fox Hunter?
Absolutely, it was. It was an obvious thing. It made sense. If you bought in season, it's going to be cheaper for one. It's also going to be in abundance, and it's going to be on your doorstep. So, I mean, these were things in London. It was every now and again you'd have a menu, and you'd have something from like a Hereford duck, and there was little things every here now and again, here and there. But so we guess what we wanted to do was to take that to its kind of max, as it were, in Wales, and buy off this farm, and we know that farmer, and then our customers were farmers, and they'd want to know where that beef come from, or where the fish was coming from, or the vegetables and what have you, because they always knew the chain. So it made sense, and it's an obvious thing to do, and now it's, well, it's totally the norm.
Yeah, you know, I can't imagine anyone being on Saturday Kitchen who wasn't into, really high welfare, local produce, the best.
At the time, you know, if you're coming out of London back in the, I don't know, the sort of the late 90s, if you were coming from a fine dining restaurant, you were used to finding strawberries and pineapple and raspberries and things in December. You'd use asparagus all year round. Nobody, in fine dining, nobody was thinking of that. It was just, what is this produce? What would go well on this plate? Where do we get it from? Yeah. A lot of the produce we used to get when I worked for Marco would come direct from France.
Yeah.
And that was the standard thing to do.
Well, of course, and Marco Pierre White at the Oak Room came from a very classical tradition. And, of course, his podcast episode is coming up in a couple of weeks. An extended version. Absolutely. And he tells that story of British food really, really interestingly right back from the 80s.
Yeah.
He came with a classical French tradition.
Mm.
But he's all the guys who came out of his kitchen, like you and Gordon Ramsay and Philip Howard and all those kind of people, they've taken it on. British food is very different to the food that Marco Pierre White cooks.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think what you got from Marco was enormous standards. I mean, the standards are amazing. He would show you, if he was going to show you how to make a fish soup, it would be the best fish soup. You know, if you were going to learn how to make a pâté, it would be the best pâté. So all you did was to move out of that kind of that super fine, refined dining and do it yourself. And you'd have the same ingredients, you'd use the same principles, but you'd serve it in a different way.
Yeah.
And then you took it away from France slightly and more towards, you know, the British countryside.
Yeah.
Because that, again, was the obvious thing to do.
Was it terrifying?
Was he terrifying? Yes, he could be terrifying, but then that was the nature of cooking at the time. But he was always fair, you know. If you cocked up, he'd let you know. But then next minute, he'd be absolutely fine.
Yeah.
So no, I always found him very fair, to be honest.
Would it be fair to say that you have moved from chef to TV presenter?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it took over. We had the restaurant for 14 years. And I was running away on a Sunday night and getting back on a Thursday night to do, and I'd do TV in that time, and then I'd do Friday, Saturday, Sunday in the restaurant, and then I'd disappear again. And it became untenable, basically. It wasn't sustainable.
You had kids at that time?
Yeah, we had two youngish kids. And the business was always set up to, my wife was at the front doing all the important stuff. I was in the kitchen. And it just didn't work if one of the parties was out of the picture. So TV took over, and while it was there, and while it was exciting, and while it got me to travel and meet new people and get out of the kitchen, I thought, why not? Let's give it a go. And I do rather like the idea of having different kind of disciplines within your life. I mean,
adventures.
You know, adventures, exactly. So, I mean, you know, it was a full-on experience working in a restaurant in the country.
Yeah.
I mean, you're never off. So, in all, you know, if an opportunity like that came along, then great, I took it. And now, yeah, here we are.
And so you're in town tonight for the Saturday Kitchen Party. The Saturday Kitchen Christmas Party. How messy is that going to be?
It's going to be... messy is a strong word. It's going to be great. We're going to meet up a little bit later. And, there'll be lots to drink.
Paint a picture of what the Christmas party is going to be like.
It's going to be quite a late night. There's going to be all sorts of folk. A lot of famouses, I have to say. A few chefs, I know, gang. And a lot of the crew coming along. It's going to be a good night. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. I love doing that show.
So tell us all about it. There's a bit of a transition, isn't there? Mm. You were sort of doing it occasionally. You are the main guy on Saturday Kitchen.
Well, I was on the subs bench for quite a long time. And then you get a lucky break.
Was it something that you kind of found your way into decided you liked?
I think lucky breaks also come with a lot of perseverance, yeah. Don't they?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of work, a lot of perseverance. But there is a big old sprinkling of luck involved, obviously. So I got it, and it is the best gig in the world. I'm not just saying that. I get to hang out with people I absolutely adore. I love meeting the guys, the chefs who come on. It's like a youth club. Well, a youth club, say it's a 45-year-old. It's like a club.
It's a community of today's chefs, which I find really interesting.
And it keeps you topical, I suppose. It keeps you up with everything that's going on, because you meet all sorts of different chefs. I get on great with the crew. We all go out afterwards and we have a right laugh. And so we're in the studio. It's just us having a lovely time. You kind of forget that you're on telly, which is the job,
the most watchable thing. And you know, it's on Saturday morning. Traditionally, that is, you know, we used to watch chefs on telly at 7 o'clock in the evening or 8 o'clock in the evening on BBC Two. Now it's Saturday morning, probably dad looking after the kids, nursing a hangover.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. People watch it religiously. Some people have it on in the background. Some people dip in and out, depending on what's going on. And, you know, so many kids are going to kids' clubs and what have you. But it's kind of ever-present. And I've got this great relationship with Ollie, the wine fella, Ollie Smith. And we pick up on conversations that we had the week before. So it's almost as though you're watching a kind of soap opera in some way.
You get to know people.
You get to know people, and you get to know the chefs and their quirks and the intricacies and things like that. And it's, I absolutely love it.
It is a very different thing to watching the kind of the Jamie Olivers. Mm. You know, it's 20 years since Jamie Oliver started The Naked Chef. Can you even believe where we've come since 1999?
Oh, it's enormous. I mean, the leap from then. I mean, I remember watching Jamie and thinking, yeah, this guy's cool. He's making cooking fun and kind of cool and sexy for your average bloke, you know. And I was in London, just how it happened to be cooking at the same time, and it was all the rage, you know. People wanted to be chefs. They wanted to go home in the evening and they wanted to grab food. And he was kind of illustrating or to people what food was out there.
Yeah, and bizarrely, what drove Jamie to the kitchens was Marco, because when he was 8 years old and cooking in the kitchen of his dad's pub, all the 16-year-old chefs wanted to be Marco.
Yeah, well, they do, you see, and as did I.
Yeah.
My first cookbook was White Heat. Yeah. And there you flick through the pages and you got this kind of chain-smoking rock star who, and he did make food sexy. Because before that time, the chefs were sort of big hat wearing sort of hotel, bit fat, that typical sort of stereotype. But this guy was totally different, and we all looked at him and thought, God, we want to do that. So no, I didn't know that much.
And of course Marco does explain exactly how that happened and says his hair was all tousled because he never had time to wash it.
Because they were doing sort of 18, 19 hour days.
It was just sweat.
Ridiculously, you know, day in, day out.
Yeah. After the break, we talk about Food Unwrapped, which he's been presenting on Channel 4 since 2013. I asked him if food itself has changed during his tenure.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Yes, it has. It's been a real eye-opener, that show. And it's strange how the two now go hand in hand, because I can stand on the stage at Saturday Kitchen and we're talking about a certain ingredient, and then it'll trigger a bit of information, a bit of knowledge that you've long forgotten. And you go, oh, do you know what? You know, do you know how this happens or this how this works? And it's just that little kind of extra layer of information. And so I'm really glad I'd do the two. We've done all sorts of stories. It's opened my eyes to all sorts of things that you just take for granted. I mean, I've been in food for 20 or 25 years now. And there's things that you don't question. And then it makes you question them. You know, I didn't question why in a slice of ham there's no hole. You just presume, oh, it's a slice of ham. But then you see how that slice of ham gets in that packet. It's like, wow, it blows your mind. Animal welfare, all sorts of issues has got to get raised. And it's...
The rise of veganism?
Yeah, that too.
Well, go on, you've raised your eyes there. I'm going to ask you about
that one. I think it's... What do you want to ask me?
Well, okay, I'm picking up from you there, Matt, that there might be a bit of antipathy.
It's... I tell you what, it's... I think... What I resent is there's kind of half information out there. There's a certain amount of information that's come through, and because of social media, it then gets escalated into the God-given truth, and it's not always the way. So somebody will jump on some study that will say, we're eating too many animals, or we're eating the wrong kind of animal, or whatever it is. And you need to look at all the balanced facts and arguments.
Yes.
So I think it can be, information in the wrong hands can be a very dangerous thing. Although I have to say, it's clearly we all need to be eating less meat.
Less but better. Hashtag less but
exactly,
better.
Exactly. Yeah. Less but better. And I think, I was watching a show the other night actually, and it suddenly occurred to me, if I sat down in a restaurant and I looked at a menu and I was made aware where that meat come from, I would probably think twice about buying it. So if I'm in a Chinese restaurant, for example, and I want my pork ribs, if I know that pork has come from some vile farm, I wouldn't buy it. If I knew it would come from a high welfare farm, I would. I think it's giving people the choice. I think we need more information.
But you've actually been to some of those farms, haven't you, through Food Unwrapped?
I have, and there's nothing quite like an intensive pig farm. It's just brutal. I mean, my honest opinion, I'm not all about organic, but free range, absolutely. You go to a free range pig farm, there might be thousands of pigs on that farm and you could hear a pin drop, because they're happy, they're content, they're outside, they're roaming around, they're not on top of each other. You go inside, take them into a barn, my God, the noise is just horrendous. And they're not happy. And the difference, and that's really changed my opinion on pig farming, for sure.
And of course, we know that the impact of food production on the planet is the biggest contributor to climate change. And I'm wondering, you know, whether you and your community of Saturday Kitchen guys, you know, do you talk about that? Do you see yourselves as the messengers?
I think you have to be careful. You have to, I mean, food is for everyone. There's no point, and I'm absolutely not into standing up and go, yes, you have to have free range, yes, you have to have organic, because people can't afford it. Not everyone can afford it.
Afford less but better?
They can afford less but better, possibly. If you've got five kids, you know, there's a lot of people out there with a lot of kids and they've got a lot of mouths to feed. You've got to pick and choose, and you've got to...
A lot of people all around the world eating vegetarian food 5 days a
week. Yeah, okay. I just think, no, it's not for me to stand up and preach. I think it's our job to make people aware, give people a choice and say, yes, you could afford this, or you could do this, and you could do this. I just, yes,
and
go on.
And is that because you're on telly? Do you feel, can I put Matt Tebbutt back in the kitchen of the Fox Hunter?
Oh, that's a different story.
You could have preached there, couldn't you?
Yeah, you can say what you want, but you're gonna have an argument in a confined space with five other guys. But you just got to be, you've got to be careful, especially these days, because people misconstrue the conversation. And suddenly what you say will be taken out of context, it'll be printed somewhere else, and then you don't know where you are. And you can lose your job, and we all know you can lose your job overnight, and I do not want to do that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And presumably, particularly with social media, because people, rather than just the press, will kind of jump on a bandwagon and start...
Totally.
Talking about you in a way that is not constructive.
No, totally. And you have to remember, I mean, Saturday morning is not necessarily... People are just waking up. Maybe they've been out, they've had it every night, they've got a hangover. It's not the time, it's not the platform to start spouting your personal views. It's a platform to entertain, to celebrate food, and to showcase people.
Does that feel like a split in your personality?
Not so much as me being restrained, okay. I guess, about what my personal views are. But it's no different to being a newsreader and having your personal views. Basically, you're just relaying information.
But, okay, so we've already talked about how that conversation has changed. Mm. When the national conversation changes again, so that... I mean, I can't imagine in the next 10 years we're going to be not talking about the increase in veganism. The less but better will have gone absolutely mainstream by that time.
Yeah.
Will that be sanctioned by your producers? Do you have that conversation with your producers? Or is there an assumption that you can't preach? Is there an assumption of what the national conversation is right now?
There absolutely is. Because we've addressed the plastic issue. So Saturday Kitchen has decided it's gone completely single-use plastic free, which is throwing up challenges, especially with dairy and things like that. It's also... It's one of those things. Do you remember when recycling came? When recycling hit Wales, everyone was up in arms because they had to sort through their rubbish. And then very quickly, people get used to it. It's one of those things. So when we went single-use plastic free, you know, if your chef wants to roll something in cling film and poach it, you can't. You have to think something out. And initially, it's, you know, you throw your hands in the air, you go, oh my God, what am I going to do, blah, blah, blah. You can soon think around it.
What do you use? Somebody said to me about sous vide the other day. You can't use sous vide because it's in plastic.
That's a very good question. Do people sous vide things anymore? I don't know. It's very 2000, isn't it? I was never really into sous vide, to be honest. I brought a machine once and I used to use it as a cake stand. It was just such a pain in the ass to buy the bags all the time.
Well, I suppose what people would do with sous vide is they kind of get a bowl of water that's of a certain temperature and they'll put a plastic bag with some stuff in it. I mean, that's sous vide, isn't it?
Yeah, well, basically, yeah. I mean, that's a very good question. Nobody's actually sort of bought that up. But, I mean, we don't do that on the show. But there's lots of sort of tricks that people are saying. You know, if you're proving bread, for example, get shower caps. From the, you know, from your cheap hotel, you know, those nasty plastic shower caps, put those over a bowl and you can reuse them, stuff like that. Or just make sure you reuse plastic, because if you're using it, it ain't going to end up in bloody ocean, is it?
So those are conversations you're having in producer meetings?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, let's go back to the veganism thing. There are too many cows on this earth. There are too many animals on this earth, and it's because of the demand
in factory farms.
In factory farms, exactly. because there are too many people demanding meat now, and meat is much cheaper. But what I disagree with is the fact that, you know, I live in Wales and I see these hill farmers who are having a tough time as it is. So what I don't want to see is that the veganers are going, we can't eat animals at all, because these poor sods are going to be out of business, and they have a tough time as it is. People still want to eat meat. So those farms, I would be hard, you know, if you told me they affect the environment, I would seriously doubt that. I would have thought
it's,
they're pretty
It's about
neutral.
Moderation. I mean, I think that's what the message of now is. It's back to everything in moderation.
But I think what's going to happen is that there's going to be this spike in veganism, and then it's as it drops, we're going to be left, the public consciousness is going to be left with the fact that veganism is an option, and it's a much greater option than it ever was. I mean, 20 years ago, when we sort of set up the restaurant, vegetarianism wasn't anywhere near what it was now. Dietary requirements, there weren't any. And now it's a huge thing. And now it's become the norm. And veganism will become the norm. And there will be menus available, and there will be all sorts of options for people. So that will be a good thing.
And presumably on Saturday Kitchen you do the very same thing. What percentage of the stuff that you cook on Saturday Kitchen would be vegetarian?
Quite a lot vegetarian. I couldn't tell you the percentage, but we embrace that quite a lot. Veganism is, I mean, to be honest, I'd love to be educated. I think it's a really, really tricky thing.
Read Mara Soda. She's done a very good book called East on, which is my absolute go-to on veganism.
It's the dairy. How do you make things tasty without dairy?
Condiments.
Really?
Soy, mushrooms, Bosch as well. Bosch have done it brilliantly.
Okay.
I'm cooking Bosch Christmas lunch this year, and I'm not a vegan.
Really? Mm. Why is that?
Because I tried it out, and it's genuinely tasty.
And what is it?
It's mushrooms with lots of red wine reduction. You cook it for a very long time. Mm. Mushrooms with chestnuts.
Okay.
Lots of
you go to the kind
of
the
real umami real lovely, lovely stuff.
Okay, there you go. So that, as a chef, that's challenging. That's exciting. And those are the things that sort of, you know, spark my enthusiasm. Yeah, it's not people spouting, you don't eat meat, you know, you're killing the planet.
Yeah.
It's like, no, let's change things sort of incrementally.
Yeah. So what is on the Christmas table at the Tebbutt household?
I'm going to my sister-in-law's this year. I think we've got turkey this year. I'm going to get a goose because I just like those hanging around, quite frankly. I got some beef from my local taxi driver who's got a farm. And he has to, incidentally, he has to drive taxis to make his farm work. So I bought a couple of joints from him. So those are going to be in the fridge. Christmas Day is just about getting together and getting a little bit smashed, isn't it, really? Getting through lunch and trying not to fall asleep. I like the whole sort of spread. I like having things in the fridge. I like having coronation chicken sandwiches, I like, you know, all that kind of the comfort with cheese. I want cheese everywhere. That's what gets me going.
Comfort, sitting back, relaxing. You don't have to do much work over
just
Christmas.
Decadence.
Do you do a lot of the cooking?
Yeah, I do. Whenever I'm at home, I love cooking. It's a very different thing than restaurant cooking. I much more prefer it now because you don't have everything at your fingertips. You've got a limited cupboard, so creatively you have to be a bit more clever. I think.
And what about 2020? What are you looking forward to next year?
2020, what's that bringing? Hopefully more Saturday Kitchens. Hopefully a lot more Saturday Kitchens. Food Unwrapped rolls on. Potentially going to Peru or South Korea. That'll be good.
What are you going there for?
I'm going there to look at a couple of stories for Food Unwrapped. We're looking at the moment. I'm off to the Cayman Islands. So you're doing a lot of travel, actually. That'll be fun. My kids are having their GCSEs and their A-levels, so that'll be great.
Joy.
Yeah.
Get off to South Korea immediately.
that'll be fun. I don't know what else. Got a trip to Italy planned. Going back to Puglia.
More of
a book.
A book? Tell us about the book. What would you like to write?
I'd like to do a book about peasant food. I want to do European peasant food. Because I think it's the best food in the world, quite frankly. And now I've got to get a publisher interested. Easier said than done.
Happy Christmas. Let's hope it's around the corner for you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I look forward to that. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to The Delicious Podcast. I'll be back next week to find out what Christmas is like in the Hairy Households with Cy King and Dave Myers of the Hairy Bikers. I'll see you then.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.